Chapter 5. Inventing the Samurai. It might seem that an invisible wall separates samurai and non-samurai, and thus we think of their inherent differences. Samurai could wear two swords and use surnames, whereas commoners could not. A samurai resided in the castle towns, while peasants lived far away in the countryside. Commoner-warrior relations were often antagonistic. Commoners had to pay taxes to the warrior regime, and warriors, in theory, could cut down a commoner if he insulted a samurai, a practice referred to as a disrespect killing, burei uchi. As generalizations, these might be true sometimes. Records indicate that in one domain, a disrespect killing occurred about once every 4 years. But rather than trace the differences and antagonisms between samurai and commoners, we should consider their similarities. If the age of the samurai began during the Tokugawa period, then so too did the modern idealized image of Japanese warriors. In establishing the samurai as a distinct social group, the shoguns unwittingly created an idealized image of the samurai that was available for consumption by commoners as well. The samurai might have numbered no more than 8% of the national population, but the invention of samurai identity during the Tokugawa era penetrated commoner culture. Commoners imitated, celebrated, parodied, and criticized samurai. When swordsmanship became a social activity to help create bonds among samurai men, wealthy commoner men wanted to participate. Manuals that taught samurai men how to conduct themselves in a romantic relationship with their juniors became popular among wealthy merchants, too. Even kabuki theater, the exemplar of urban culture, associated with red light districts, commoners, and gaudy presentation, existed in Edo City initially as theater performed mostly in daimyo compounds for a warrior audience. The collapse of the last samurai regime is often explained in terms of domestic political upheavals, economic woe, and foreign pressure. But at least some of the decline can be explained by the recognition among samurai and commoners that an irreconcilable gap existed between samurai ideals and samurai reality, a gap that had been widening throughout the Tokugawa period. Even the most mundane features of samurai life became a source of fascination for commoners. The most widely read text in Tokugawa Japan was the Warrior Roster, Bukon. Published several times a year, it listed details of all the daimyo in Japan and most of the prominent samurai working in the shogunate. It included family crests, clan lineage, addresses, gifts received from and given to the shogun, the distance from a lord's compound to Edo Castle, and the positions samurai held in the Tokugawa regime. Samurai needed to know who their colleagues and superiors were within the Tokugawa bureaucracy, especially because jobs constantly changed. But the quantity of rosters published suggests that commoners purchased them even more than samurai. Commoners in big cities like Edo, Osaka, or Kyoto, where the rosters were sold, needed these details to serve their samurai customers. Identifying a samurai crest during a daimyo procession or knowing where to deliver products was part of doing business, but possessing and updating the rosters for free at a bookstore several times a year by having new pages pasted in was much like the excitement of obtaining the latest baseball roster in the modern world. In other words, commoners enjoyed access to information about warriors that had been unavailable to them before the 17th century. The simple act of publishing information about samurai and daimyo differentiated Tokugawa-era warriors from their predecessors. This process had roots in an earlier era when warrior identity was defined through texts. Elite, literate warriors in the 15th and 16th centuries learned warrior culture through etiquette manuals, kojitsu, that described appropriate behavior such as how to dress during ceremonies or to conduct oneself during an archery competition. Warrior customs and rituals dated back to the Kamakura period, but applied mostly to the housemen who lived in or frequented Kamakura City itself. Writings about warrior culture in general increased during the Muromachi period, when warriors and nobility interacted with greater frequency and royal culture influenced warrior thought. Etiquette manuals from that time continued to be popular during the Tokugawa period, but the rosters did more than simply trace the contours of elite warrior culture. They defined exactly what made warriors important. Moreover, they created a degree of occupational uniformity that had not existed much before the 17th century. Newly installed lords and elite warriors took seriously the pressure to define themselves. Many unemployed samurai, ronin, who had been left adrift in the aftermath of the Warring States period, found work as teachers and advisors to daimyo in Edo and castle towns throughout Japan. These masterless samurai helped families plan and participate in warrior ceremonies that increasingly became part of warrior social life, especially in Edo. Minor lords had to create genealogies in order to foster clan identity where previously there had been none. Wandering samurai also published military histories and military science books, such as the early Tokugawa-era text Military Mirror of Kai, whose author, Obata Kagenori, became a sought-after teacher of military science. Warrior Ideals. Commoners were exposed to warrior values through popular culture. In Edo, kabuki began as theater for largely warrior audiences, and as such, plays celebrated warrior heroes and values. After kabuki opened to the masses, the Edo dandy replaced the warrior as the archetypal hero, but even he was depicted as embodying warrior traits such as bravery, martial prowess, and loyalty. The most frequently performed kabuki play was called The Treasury of Loyal Retainers, also known as the Akko Incident or the 47 Ronin. It appeared first as a puppet play based on a historical event that occurred in the early 18th century when a daimyo named Asano attacked a senior shogunate samurai, Kira, during a ceremony within the shogun's castle. It is unclear why Asano assaulted Kira, but it is commonly believed that Kira insulted Asano for not knowing proper etiquette. Kira, a master of ceremony for nearly 40 years, was in charge of ensuring that all attendees knew their roles, including the much younger, small domain-holding Asano. Since drawing a sword in the shogun's castle was forbidden, shogunate police immediately arrested Asano, executed him by seppuku, ritual suicide by disembowelment and decapitation performed by a trusted colleague, if one was lucky, and dissolved his Akko domain, forcing his retainers to become masterless samurai, ronin. After nearly 2 years of planning to avenge their lord's death, 46 of the 47 ronin attacked and killed Kira. Some contemporaries argued that the ronin hoped to avoid harsh punishment because their actions reflected loyalty to their lord. Instead, they were sentenced to seppuku. Earlier warrior regimes had no single form of capital punishment, nor did pre-Tokugawa-era samurai disembowel themselves often. But Tokugawa-era samurai idealized seppuku as warrior machismo of a bygone time, going as far as writing manuals standardizing the ritual. The Tokugawa shogunate established seppuku as capital punishment. Although the incident itself passed with little comment when it first occurred, audiences loved the dramatized versions. The attack and mass ritualized suicide made for dramatic scenes. Moreover, these were lowly samurai acting in unison against authorities and sacrificing themselves as a group, a theme that might have appealed to urban commoners who often interacted with low-ranking warriors. On the one hand, the historical event and its subsequent popularity represented a crisis for Tokugawa samurai because it exposed the tension between warrior ideals and warrior reality. Samurai, as men of action, were supposed to display loyalty to their lord's clan and domain. They celebrated past warrior heroes and their bravado. On the other hand, samurai were no longer supposed to be violent. The shogunate attempted to prevent war at the top among daimyo through rules for daimyo activity, such as expanding castles, pursuing warrior crimes across borders, and the like. It also forbade samurai from engaging in fights and punishing offenders with execution. Samurai writers promoted Confucian learning and self-cultivation, not violence, as admirable traits. In other words, how could a samurai think of himself as a warrior in a world with no warfare and without being violent? That tension was never fully resolved during the Tokugawa period, and samurai pundits did not agree on any one image of the ideal samurai. Some samurai writers praised the 47 Ronin because they acted out of a personal sense of loyalty to their lord. Others argued that the Ronin had acted improperly because it was not Kira who killed their lord. The shogunate executed Asano for his criminal offense. The shogunate's law trumped personal notions of action, honor, and loyalty. One writer criticized them for waiting more than a year to carry out an attack when they should have killed Kira immediately after Asano's execution. Hayashi Hoko, head of the Confucian Academy in Edo, synthesized the two views, citing classic Chinese texts to explain the heart of being a warrior. First, I will view their vendetta from the perspective of the hearts of the 46 men. It was imperative that they not share the same sky with their master's enemy, and that they sleep on reeds, using their sword as a pillow, both quotations from the Chinese Record of Rites. To hang on to life by enduring shame and humiliation is not the way of the samurai. We must also consider the vendetta from the perspective of the law. Anyone who sees the law as his enemy must be put to death. These two perspectives are hardly identical, but they might complement each other in operation without contradiction. Above, there must be humane rulers and wise ministers who govern by clarifying law and promulgating decrees. Below, there must be loyal retainers and righteous samurai who readily vent their anger in the determined pursuit of their cause. The 18th-century book In the Shadow of Leaves, Hagakure, contains the most extreme reaction to the bind between the violent legacy of warriors and their pacification. Tokugawa warriors would, in theory, be executed for fighting each other regardless of the reason. So, what should a samurai do if he is insulted by another samurai, especially a lower-ranking one? He could be executed and his family punished if he attacked the offender. But if he ignored the slight, he risked losing face in front of his warrior peers. The answer, according to Yamamoto, the book's author, was to choose death. Yamamoto had his own opinion of the 47 Ronin. They should have killed Kira immediately without worrying about their fate. Dishonor was worse than the death of an individual samurai because his death is singular, while dishonor can spread to his family and, more importantly, could affect the reputation of his lord's clan. The Hagakure's opening line, "The way of the samurai is in death," and his criticism of local samurai and the shogunate made it quite controversial. It circulated privately among samurai in the Nabeshima domain and was generally unknown until its resurrection as propaganda during the height of war and fascism during the 1930s. Within the Tokugawa world, violence was no longer appropriate samurai behavior. Though cultivating the self by studying the Chinese classics like the Analects was part of warrior learning before the 17th century, Tokugawa samurai values relied on later Chinese interpretations of those ancient texts, a school of thought called Neo-Confucianism. Neo-Confucianism informed Tokugawa samurai attitudes toward lord, family, and society. Cultured learning, bun, should still be tempered with training in martial learning, bu, argued warrior leaders. But there were no longer opportunities to display one's martial prowess other than within the confines of martial arts practice. Martial arts had become nothing more than the physical manifestation of bun-focused cultivation. These values did not square with the reality of most samurai who, like Katsu Kokuchi, worried about basic survival. and if they had at least some pretension of wealth, they were more interested in pursuing extracurricular activities. The putative golden age of samurai identity always existed in an idealized past. As one samurai commentator complained in 1818, in past ages it was common for warriors to mock those who pursue elegance as courtiers. Now, though, it is the better warriors who behave like courtiers. The majority have become like women. Samurai writers connected this spiritual impoverishment to economic decline, and they often blamed urbanization for the stain of commoner fashions on warrior lifestyle. One intellectual chastised warriors in Edo for spending money as if living in an inn. By being forced to move back into the countryside, samurai would be allowed to return to a self-sufficient lifestyle, live a simpler life, and relearn the purer warrior values reminiscent of an earlier age. Others noted that urban commoners would follow samurai to the countryside and focus on farming rather than working for the large samurai populations in castle towns. Beginning in the 18th century, the shogunate enacted a series of reforms to address the twin problems of samurai economic distress and declining samurai identity. Matsudaira Sadanobu, the grandson of the 8th Tokugawa shogun, a senior advisor in the shogunate and the architect of late 18th century reforms, envisioned a Confucian-styled society based on order, with the morally superior gentleman warriors firmly at the top. The reform included edicts that tried to censor publications, curtail merchant activity, and eliminate heterodox teachings, but he was particularly interested in cutting shogunate expenses and demanded that samurai practice frugality and focus on developing their bun and bu. He too idealized the rural origins of the samurai and took his own samurai retainers on hikes in the countryside. Despite the warrior authorities' attempts to reinvigorate samurai identity and behavior, samurai themselves poked fun at the image. A well-known satirical response to Sadanobu's reform went, "Bunbu, bunbu, I can't sleep at night." Many of these writers, who came from low-ranking samurai families, abandoned dead-end careers for intellectual pursuits. One such man was Hiraga Genai, a teacher, writer, and inventor who lampooned the stuffy samurai image in an essay titled On Farting, 1771, about a performer who excelled at farting as a musical talent. Genai used a country bumpkin samurai named Crankshaw Stonington, Esquire, as the straight man to critique warrior values. Crankshaw admonished the fartist and the crowd, telling them that the shogunate allowed street performances in order to teach the public about fealty and loyalty. He cited the 47 Ronin incident depicted in the Treasury of Loyalty Retainers as an example. Flatulence, he added, is, after all, a personal matter and should not be aired in public. Any proper samurai would be mortified to the point of suicide if he were inadvertently to let, fly in polite company. Genai's critique illustrates how commoners appropriated culture in their own ways, even as the shogunate tried to promote warrior values via popular culture. He also mocked the notion of samurai honor. Even a harmless fart could push a samurai to commit suicide rather than risk public shame. Samurai parody frequently appeared in popular literature as well. The Tokugawa period's most famous novel, Shank's Mare, written by the son of a minor warrior, recounts the adventures of two men, Kita and Yaji, who drink, play, and bumble their way from Kyoto to Edo. In a roadside bar, the two encounter a drunk samurai, a few young women, one of them named Shime, and a buffoon. "Oh, you horrid man," cried the girls. "Look at his face. Look what strange eyes he makes. How bright and glaring they are." "You are insulting," cried the samurai in a sudden burst of anger. "Look at your own faces instead of mine." He stood up, but the waitresses caught hold of him. "There, there," they said. "There's nothing for you to get angry about." "Don't be rude, Shime," said the buffoon. "I'll tell you what we'll do. We're getting rather bored, so to liven things up, let's be as jolly as if we were in a steam bath. A steam bath is an empty bath, said the samurai. He takes me for an idiot. I have a good mind to beat him for his rudeness. Apparently, the samurai was an angry drunk. The samurai summoned the girls and the buffoon to entertain him for the evening, but in the end, he tried to reinforce the notion that non-samurai should know their proper place when interacting with a samurai, twice accusing them of rudeness. But rather than cower from him, they continued to tease him, knowing that his drunkenness and futile attempts to lord his status over them only made him seem powerless. Writers and artists understood that bodily functions were the same across class divides, and they used bathroom humor to critique any group, especially samurai, that put on airs. The artist Hokusai, famous for his Great Wave woodblock print, published a book of prints containing a scene titled Privy, which depicts samurai retainers standing dutifully by while their superior relieves himself. The three retainers believe in the samurai ideals all too much, sacrificing their own comfort in the name of duty. Commoners and warrior identity. Unlike their pre-Tokugawa counterparts, commoners helped create warrior culture. They purchased warrior rosters, studied swordsmanship, hired warrior tutors, and bought military-related books. They celebrated samurai ideals in popular culture, both in rural areas and in the cities. Villagers in the countryside organized kabuki plays that featured battle scenes with large casts that incorporated members of local youth associations. Quite simply, war plays broke the monotony of everyday life. Some commoners even studied martial arts, not only for self-defense and as a way to rub elbows with samurai, but also to use the techniques in rural theater and village festivals. To a certain extent, samurai writers promoted commoner participation in warrior culture. Commoners either read or listened to public recitations of a 14th-century war tale called The Chronicle of Great Peace, Taiheiki. The Taiheiki recounted the conflict between the northern and southern courts in that era. The authors glorified Emperor Go Daigo's general Kusunoki Masashige and celebrated values such as loyalty and self-sacrifice. As an educational text, it taught young commoners how to read Chinese characters, kanji, and imparted moral lessons. The Taiheiki was so well known that authors used it as a historical setting to comment on politically sensitive events, the 47 Ronin incident, for example, rather than risk arrest for writing about taboo topics. Other pre-Tokugawa period warrior texts circulated among commoners and samurai. Books like A Woman's Imagawa and A Commoner's Imagawa copied themes found in the 15th century Imagawa letter, a widely read letter of advice to warriors, and emphasized the importance of cultured learning, bun. Of course, not all peasants could read, but some village headmen lectured to villagers about morals using the same military writings popular among samurai. The shogunate alternatively forbade and encouraged the most martial of samurai activities, namely swordsmanship and archery. Consider the following 1805 edict from the shogunate that circulated throughout the 19th century in many domains surrounding Edo. We have heard that in this region there are unemployed samurai wandering about. Peasants are learning martial arts and gathering together for practice, which might cause them to ignore their agricultural work. They forget their status and become uppity. They should be told to stop, and martial art instructors should not introduce their arts to the villagers. The edict introduces several issues facing warrior authorities during the 19th century. It begins by illustrating samurai unemployment. Ronin, who were desperate to make a living, ignored shogunal decrees that prohibited them from making warrior culture available to commoners. By providing samurai culture to commoners in the form of martial arts instruction or tutoring, they unintentionally recognized its universal appeal and applicability to anyone who could afford it. Wealth, not birth, could buy at least some warrior fantasy. Commoners had eclipsed warriors as an economic force, even though warriors controlled the land. Sadanobu's reforms, and the ones that followed it, failed to solve the decline of samurai identity and economic woe. The edict also demonstrates that the regime could not prevent commoners from appropriating warrior culture in their own way. Whether commoners were emulating or parodying them, samurai did not control how they were perceived or how they were portrayed. As economic and social disorder spread throughout the greater Edo region during the mid-19th century, the shogunate began to rely on commoners to provide self-defense. Its Kanto Regulatory Patrol, created to deal with rising criminality in the Edo hinterland, depended on rural elites for information about local criminals. Villages joined together to form defense leagues. They were organized by larger, wealthier villages that hosted criminal holding centers. The village headman received privileges typically reserved for samurai, the right to wear swords and use surnames in official documents. League members practiced swordsmanship for its practical use and to strengthen internal social cohesion. The increasing presence of Westerners in the seas around Japan exposed many structural weaknesses of warrior rule. Officials in Edo were so worried that the imperial Ise shrine was vulnerable to Westerners that after an 1855 inspection, they asked the Shinto priests to survey temple bells that could be melted down to be used for cannons and rifles, and to start training commoners in martial arts, especially gunnery, as a first step toward local defense against invasion. This effort culminated in 1863 when the shrine formed a peasant militia. Peasant militias became more common in the mid-19th century as foreign and domestic threats were too much for the shogunate to contain with warriors alone. Warrior reality, it seems, could not match the heroic feats enacted on stage, in books, and in the fencing academies. Collapse and Restoration. There were many problems that led to the Meiji Restoration, 1868. A conflict between samurai, led by Tozama Daimyo, who fought in the name of the teenage Meiji Emperor, and the Tokugawa shogunate and its allies. Although it was not as large a war as the U.S. Civil War, it nonetheless has the status of being the mythic origin of modern Japan. In the decades before the Restoration, several interconnected problems squeezed the samurai regime and warriors in general: the threat from Western countries, strife within the shogunate itself, and the changing relationship between samurai and non-samurai. These pressures originated in the early 17th century, at the latest, and arose from policies enacted by the warrior regime to maintain samurai hegemony. By the early 19th century, leaders in the shogunate worried about how to address the growing presence of Westerners on the edges of Japan. In 1825, as more European ships tested Japan's waters, coastal daimyo were ordered to fire on those ships to drive them away, an effort that was largely unsuccessful. The shogunate eventually abandoned that order, but it illustrates the shogunate's inability to adequately prepare for foreign threats. More American whaling ships in the Pacific and increasing trade in China led to a rising number of shipwrecked sailors in Japan. The British, French, Dutch, and Russians had been trying to expand commercial access and diplomatic relations throughout Asia, and the shogunate did not want to fall prey, as the Chinese had done during the Opium Wars, 1839 to 1842, to a series of conflicts over Britain's opium trafficking in China. To some warriors, the Europeans were nothing more than opportunistic merchants, an occupation that samurai deemed selfish and lowly. But these warriors believed that if they could contain foreign merchant activity to Nagasaki, they could avoid diplomatic entanglements. Unlike in Europe, trade among East Asian countries at the time did not presuppose any diplomatic relations between governments. During the latter half of the 18th century, after repeated attempts by Russians to open relations to Japan, The shogunate allowed them to conduct minor trade in Nagasaki, hoping that this would mollify them. It did not, and a Russian captain landed on Tsushima Island in 1861 and demanded that the daimyo there lease him land. Unable to scare the Russians off, the shogunate had to ask the British for help. Western pressure culminated with the arrival of U.S. Admiral Matthew Perry in Edo Bay in 1853. The shogunate had heard from the Dutch and the Ryukyu kingdom that Perry was on his way, but the appearance of his black ships so close to Edo instead of Nagasaki caused a panic within the shogunate's leadership. Many samurai were benignly curious rather than deeply perturbed. Warrior officials and American ship personnel peacefully examined each other's weapons. Nonetheless, Perry's demand that the shogunate respond to President Millard Fillmore's request to establish at least limited trade and diplomatic exchange, if not an outright treaty, affected the shogunate's relationship to both the daimyo and the imperial institution. Perry promised to return in a year's time with better-armed ships. In the interim, the chief senior advisor in the shogunate, Abe Masahiro, broke Tokugawa precedent by asking all of the daimyo, including those from the outer domains who were typically shut out of the formal decision-making process in the shogunate, for their opinions on how to respond to the Americans. Why, after a little over 200 years of keeping them at political arm's length, would the shogunate need their voice? The answer to that question connects to an issue that all prominent warrior families had faced since at least the beginning of the Kamakura period, and possibly earlier, the problem of succession. The Tokugawa shogun at the time, Ieyoshi, died only weeks after Perry arrived the first time, and his successor, Ieyasada, was weak politically and physically, having suffered from several diseases since childhood. Abe and his supporters controlled the shogunate's policies, but did not do so with impunity. He needed consensus because the shogunate was weak. Unfortunately for Abe, a consensus was not forthcoming. Daimyo response ranged from some form of opening the country to the Americans by engaging in trade and learning from their science and technology, to an insistence that all American requests be rejected, even if doing so risked an unwinnable war. When Perry returned in 1854, Abe signed the Treaty of Kanagawa. Neither he nor the daimyo who supported a treaty embraced the West per se. The treaty did not guarantee the Americans much, and Japan avoided war, but criticism from many daimyo, politically influential nobles in Kyoto, and samurai loyalists to the emperor and its institution was swift and powerful. When studying the Tokugawa shogunate, it is easy to forget about the other perennial issue in samurai history, every regime's interaction with the court and emperor in Kyoto. The Kyoto nobility did not influence political and social events in Tokugawa Japan to the same degree it did before the 17th century. The nobility and emperors remained in Kyoto, and few Japanese knew or cared about them. People encountered royalty only in history writing. But because history writing is always done with an agenda, whether the author knows it or not, people understood the imperial institution through the lens of samurai authors. Historical works published throughout the Tokugawa period had to assess Go Daigo's Kenmu Restoration of 1333. Was his southern court the legitimate imperial line that had been wronged? Was Ashikaga Takauji a rebel who acted against the imperial institution, or an admirable leader who was justified in creating a new shogunate once Go Daigo's leadership had descended into chaos? Was Takauji to be demonized or celebrated? And what did the answers to those questions mean for warrior legitimacy as it related to the supposed divine lineage of the emperors? No single view dominated, but when Kyoto residents awoke on a late winter morning in 1863, to find the decapitated heads of three Ashikaga shoguns pilloried along the Kamo River, clearly the pro-emperor views had gained currency as never before. The accompanying placard, labeled Vengeance of Heaven, portended bad things to come for the shogunate. Heaven, in this act, sided with the imperial institution and not with the Ashikaga shoguns who inherited Takaoji's legacy. The Tokugawa period was the apex of warrior dominance in Japanese history, and especially shogunal authority over the court. Political dominance should not be understood as a complete lack of political influence for the court, however. Respect for the emperor and the imperial legacy spread among the samurai in the latter half of the Tokugawa era, in part as a result of history writing. In the 17th century, the Mito domain, led by a daimyo family tied to the Tokugawa clan itself, began an immense history writing project titled The Great History of Japan. It was completed in 1906. As with much scholarly work in Japan before the 20th century, the text was influenced by Chinese thought, in this case Neo-Confucianism. It also followed Chinese historical style by tracing change over time through the descent of the emperor. Samurai teachers used the content as teaching materials, and its focus on the emperors influenced several generations of samurai who took seriously the twin themes of loyalty and imperial prestige. By the time Perry arrived, writers who had followed a wide range of schools of thought, from ancient Chinese learning to nativist teachings about Japan, and even those who dedicated their lives to studying imported European texts, had been convincing many that the Tokugawa clan and its shogunate ruled only at the behest of imperial grace. Newfound respect for the imperial institution connected to foreign policy, with disastrous results. In 1846, an imperial rescript commanded the shogunate to build coastal defenses. In 1858, the emperor rejected the shogunate's attempt to seek after-the-fact approval for a commercial treaty it signed with the United States. Criticisms leveled against the shogunate by nobles, daimyo, samurai, and even some commoners culminated in unprecedented violence. In 1860, a group of ronin from the Mito domain descended upon a senior counselor's entourage as it approached Edo Castle. They killed the guards, who had their swords tucked in the scabbards to protect against the snow, and assassinated the counselor, Ii Nausicaa, still in his palanquin. Throughout the 1860s, samurai from across Japan, mostly low-ranking underemployed men, left their domains for Kyoto to gather around the court and like-minded loyalist samurai. Meanwhile, the shogunate tried its best to pursue détente with Kyoto and its supporters, arranging a marriage between the emperor's daughter and a shogun. It also dutifully answered a summons from the court to send the shogun to Kyoto in 1863, illustrating the extent to which the warrior regime had lost its control of the emperor. Humiliated and unable to deny the emperor's command, the shogunate promised to follow an imperial order it could not keep. The shogun, in his ancient role as the general who would expel the barbarians, agreed to force Europeans out of Japan. While many daimyo played little role in the Kyoto shogunate politics, and did not feel directly affected by Westerners, they still faced pressure from commoners in their domains. Unlike other revolutions in world history, Japan did not experience a revolutionary movement among commoners. Peasants complained about tax hardships and the bad behavior of local officials, but they never attacked the basic structure of the daimyo shogunate warrior regime. They drew on the Confucian concept of benevolence to plead for leniency, and if they did not receive it, they could protest. It was a risky strategy, and ringleaders were often executed, sometimes alongside their family members, children included. The most desperate villages sent men to Edo to appeal directly to the shogun himself as he traveled through the city in a covered palanquin. But it was a tactic that could work. In the best-case scenario, the shogunate would investigate a troubled area and force the daimyo to make reforms. At the very least, a protest illustrated daimyo incompetence and could lead to ridicule and punishment, such as confiscating the domain and putting another daimyo in charge. Villagers could collectively pressure their daimyo, but merchant groups could yank purse strings. Wealthy merchants and rural entrepreneurs held sway over some rank-and-file samurai, and in some cases even had access to daimyo. As moneylenders, they could advise daimyo how to enact economic reforms within the domain. Daimyo often looked to commoners to expand industries that would bring more income and tax revenue into the domain. Among middle-ranking samurai, who drew their stipends and other resources from villages assigned to them in the countryside, several employed villagers in their mansions in Edo, or followed demands that the family change its spendthrift ways or be cut off from future loans. And when Japan's economy encountered global capitalism, merchants in big cities profited from textile trade with Europeans. Trade was so successful that prices of goods skyrocketed throughout the 1860s, and these increases led to riots and smashings against warehouses where the wealthy were accused of hoarding goods. Among the many imperial loyalists were commoners, women included, who felt that they too should play a role, no matter how minor, in the future direction of Japan. The mystique and majesty of warrior rule had dwindled by the 1860s, and those who believed in warrior notions of loyalty, obligation, and action started uprisings around Japan. They attacked what they saw as the most offensive representatives in the shogunate, such as Ii Nausicaa, and enemies within their home domains and among the nobility in Kyoto. Factionalism in some domains resulted in small-scale civil wars, numbering hundreds of men on each side, in large outer domains in the south, and in the smaller but politically connected domain closer to Edo. Not a single year during the 1860s passed without some degree of political violence. The era before that decade had been relatively calm, but now the peace was destabilized by factionalism and domain civil wars, attacks against Europeans and their servants living in newly formed merchant communities in Yokohama, riots in the cities of Kyoto and Edo, and the unexpected deaths of two key political figures, the shogun Iemochi in 1866 at age 20, and the emperor Komei 1867 at age 35. The new emperor, Meiji, was only a teenager and was controlled by a handful of court nobles and their daimyo supporters. The new shogun, Yoshinobu, was a reluctant successor, not wanting to start a war with his enemies at court and no doubt fearing for his life. He returned the title of shogun to the emperor in 1867, setting up the restoration of political rule to the Meiji emperor in name, if not in reality. Yoshinobu remained the head of the Tokugawa clan, a partner with the court and emperor, and leader of the samurai bureaucrats attached to the shogunate. He mounted an attack against daimyo gathered at Kyoto, who he claimed were manipulating the young emperor. His army of 15,000 troops outnumbered those from the southwestern domains, but the battle at the villages of Toba and Fushimi on the outskirts of Kyoto did not go his way. He retreated to Edo and surrendered the Tokugawa forces to the emperor in 1868. Despite Yoshinobu's surrender, supporters of the Tokugawa clan, including a few French military attachés, continued to fight against the southern daimyo and their soldiers who composed the emperor's army. The samurai holdouts did not fight out of love for the shogunate. Indeed, when a few thousand men commandeered the shogunate's ships and left for Hakodate in the north, they created a republic and installed a Tokugawa family member as its president. Another 38 domains in the northeast formed a military alliance to fight against the 50,000 troops sent under the emperor's banner from the south. For the first time since the early 17th century, tens of thousands of troops were being mobilized for war, but they were hardly like their predecessors. Long before the war, the shogunate had been reforming its military, arming it with Western rifles and asking the French for help reorganizing its tactics. In the South, the British and other Western Europeans had been selling rifles left over from the American Civil War. Daimyo there formed peasant militias to help in coastal defense, although it was mostly samurai who were dispatched to fight in the emperor's name. Still, traditional weapons like swords, spears, halberds, and bows appeared on the battlefield. The bloodiest fighting occurred in the northeast Aizu domain, ruled by the Matsudaira clan. Despite having been given up by the Matsudaira as a hostage, Ieyasu never completely abandoned them. Branch lines of the Matsudaira clan formed after Ieyasu's death celebrated the older Matsudaira-Ieyasu connection, and they remained among the most reliable supporters of the shogunate even as it fell 2.5 centuries later. While Aizu samurai bore the brunt of the siege against Aizu Castle, their women inside took care of the wounded, tried to supply food, and packed gunpowder and ammunition in makeshift bamboo bazookas. When cannonballs landed on the roof, women covered them with wet blankets to keep them from setting fires. Although the men implored them not to, samurai women eventually joined them in battle with swords and halberds, the first people to use them in combat since at least the 16th century. Many women cut their hair to look like men, and one even donned her dead brother's clothes. In the end, nearly 200 women died in the fighting. Another 230 old men, women, and children committed suicide lest they suffer dishonor at the hands of their enemies. Years later, the Aizu domain's house elder Saigo Tonomo recounted the suicide of all the women in his family, his mother, wife, younger sister, and 5 daughters, the youngest of whom were 4 and 2. Each wrote a death poem. His 13-year-old daughter wrote, "If you take my hand and we go together, I won't get lost," to which her 16-year-old sister added, "When the time comes, I will take it as we depart for death on the mountain road." Post-Restoration Warrior Legacy. In 1872, only a few years after the Meiji Restoration, a southern ex-samurai turned modern oligarch named Ito Hirobumi delivered a speech in San Francisco. He stated, with a disregard for history, that despite a temporary civil war, the feudal system had been destroyed without firing a gun or shedding a drop of blood. History textbooks in Japan from the late 19th century to the present tend to downplay the violence of the Restoration. One prominent historian in Japan went so far as to suggest that the Meiji Restoration was a unique revolution in world history because it involved relatively little violence compared to other modern revolutions, and that the samurai abolished their own class. During a short presentation on the need to reconsider the violent and traumatic nature of the Meiji Restoration, this same historian, sitting in the audience, argued that local tourist boosters had been responsible for overemphasizing restoration violence only long after the fact. He might be right, but that still does not erase the deaths of more than 13,000 people killed during the latter half of the 1860s, most of them during the Boshin War that began after Yoshinobu's capitulation and ended in 1869. Such is the controversy of the Meiji Restoration even 150 years later. Not even the dead are given their due. The Meiji Restoration ushered in a sweeping abolition of the shogunate, the nearly 280 extant domains, and warrior status itself. The newly formed Meiji oligarchy first asked the lords to voluntarily return their domains to the emperor, effectively eliminating them. Prominent daimyo with large domains who led the restoration forfeited their domains first. Later, the government forced all daimyo to do so. Some were moved across the country to become governors in one of the 72 newly formed prefectures, but many were not. For the most part, daimyo did not bemoan their new status. They received payoffs that ensured them a comfortable retirement. Even before the restoration, a few daimyo had asked the shogunate to take control of their domains, as continuing to try to govern them had simply not been worth the effort. A samurai response to the end of the status system was mixed. The newly formed government replaced the traditional samurai stipend with bonds that were immediately bought back by the national banks. Some lower-ranking samurai profited nicely from this transaction and used the cash to establish factories and businesses. For higher-ranking samurai, however, the stipend-bond switch fell short of providing a decent living. Moreover, the physical vestiges of samurai privileges were eliminated. Samurai could no longer carry swords or maintain their distinctive hairstyle. And they no longer monopolized the military, which was now open to all males. Ex-samurai in the government enacted these laws, but even within the bureaucracy, there were widely contrary opinions. In 1869, one such official in the newly formed deliberative assembly proposed that swords no longer be carried in public by anyone but police, military, and government officials. He was dismissed from the assembly, demoted in rank, and threatened with death. This same assembly spent more time debating whether or not to abolish seppuku than on how to interact with Western countries. It voted against eliminating seppuku by 200-3, and the man who proposed the idea was assassinated. With their status abolished, many samurai could not find jobs that utilized their backgrounds. Nor were they trained to handle money. Being above financial dealings had been a source of pride during the Tokugawa period, a field of knowledge relegated to selfish merchants. Some former warriors were so impoverished that they sold the swords, armor, and other samurai objects that now fill Western museums, selling family heirlooms just to survive. Others were happy to be free from the bounds of their previous status, now able to pursue whatever occupation pleased them. A granddaughter of a samurai, who later published a history of her family, states that her grandfather, a samurai of the Mito domain, was glad to see the old system fall. He found it was easier to make a living, even though he, like all samurai, lost his traditional stipend. Far from celebrating the samurai, many Japanese in the late 19th century considered the samurai an anachronistic embarrassment, unproductive, and useless. Instead, a vogue for all things Western, even dress, spread throughout society. Local governments destroyed their abandoned castles. In the Aizu domain, the newly formed prefectural government sold off the land surrounding the castle, where much of the fighting had occurred. They opened the structure to local tourists for a 20-day viewing before tearing it down and auctioning the materials. Only one person made a bid. The land around the castle was sold off to local farmers. But by the end of the 19th century, samurai represented the putative strength of a unique, traditional Japan. The most famous ex-samurai turned modern intellectual, Fukuzawa Yukichi, who is featured on the 10,000 yen bill, is well known for celebrating the end of the status system and the Tokugawa shogunate. Nonetheless, he later bemoaned the disappearance of the samurai spirit represented by the losers of the Meiji Restoration, such as the Aizu Fallen and the Tokugawa shogunate's samurai. For their part, many of those losers now worked in the Meiji oligarchy, and the Aizu men, once regarded as hated enemies of the emperor, found newfound respect from those who celebrated Japan as a martial country. As Japan embarked on wars against China, 1894 to 1895, and Russia, 1904 to 1905, ideologues promoted the notion that now all Japanese were samurai. Kendo, a modern form of swordsmanship that used armor and point scoring, was introduced into the school system because it fostered martial spirit. Self-sacrifice and love of the emperor became a central theme in literature, film, and primary school textbooks. Hagakure, once a marginal text at best, was republished in the early 20th century and enjoyed a wide readership, especially during the 1930s, at the height of Japanese fascism. And what of the Way of the Samurai? It was not nearly as influential among the populace as it was among government officials and high-ranking military men. Most people credit Nitobe Inazo for defining Bushido for a modern audience in his book Bushido, The Soul of Japan, published in 1900 in English for Americans. But nearly a decade before Nitobe, a journalist and politician, Ozaki Yukio, described Bushido as Japan's version of gentlemanliness, comparable to Europe's notion of chivalry. His concept said nothing of martial prowess or self-sacrifice. Throughout the 1890s, intellectuals responded to Ozaki's writings about Bushido. Some used the word to describe the vitality of commerce or argued for a Christian version of Bushido, but no single definition dominated until the 20th century. Nitobe had been living in the United States during the first Bushido boom in Japan, and when his book was published in Japanese, it barely registered among anyone except interested intellectuals who deemed it too little too late. Instead, the philosopher Inoue Tetsujiro popularized the concept of Bushido as a repository for nationalism, service to the emperor, and self-sacrifice. Those themes, and samurai history in general, became central to World War II propaganda. Samurai appeared in textbooks, boys learned Japanese fencing at school, and girls practiced how to wield a glaive, naginata, a long staff with a curved blade attached to the end. After the Second World War, this wartime samurai image was taboo. Samurai films, a popular genre even during the silent film era, were censored by the American Occupation Army. Directors could still make samurai films, but they could not glorify violence, self-sacrifice, or loyalty to the emperor. A samurai film boom occurred during the 1950s after the occupation ended, when classic films such as Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai appeared, but they no longer portrayed an ultra-nationalist version of the samurai. The U.S. occupation forces also banned martial arts practice, which was seen as another vehicle for disseminating dangerous Bushido and fascist ideology. Even when martial arts like Kendo reemerged, they emphasized cooperation and competition and de-emphasized martial applicability. During the high economic growth beginning in the 1960s, the archetypal dark-suited salaryman became the new samurai. Called the corporate warrior, such a businessman remained loyal to his company and would never abandon it for a better deal elsewhere. Unlike a medieval warrior who readily switched sides or betrayed his lord. As for self-sacrifice, it was the exception that proved the rule of self-preservation for early warriors, but the business samurai was expected to sacrifice his well-being for the company. One wonders how the use of a more historically accurate image of the samurai might affect Japanese culture, business, and politics in the future. This concludes Samurai, A Very Short Introduction by Michael Wirt. Narrated by Eric Jason Martin. Copyright 2019-2021 by Oxford University Press. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2021 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.